Welcome to Common Sense Care, Parenting Gender Confused Children with Truth and Love. The gender industry's so-called affirmative care model is their one-size-fits-all answer for all people who struggle with their identity. But in no other area of education or medicine or psychology is a one-size-fits-all answer right for everybody. We believe that all children are individuals and they should be given the care and support that's most appropriate for them. So welcome back. I'm Maria Kepler.
And I'm Erin Brewer. And what are we talking about today, Maria?
Well, we're departing a little bit from just focused transgender stuff to just talking about adolescence. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the adolescent mind today.
Which is, you know, for those who don't remember being adolescents, it's such a different time. And I remember so clearly being a teenager and some of those feelings that I had and that sense of not being understood by grownups.
Yeah, it's that shift. I mean, adolescence is a time of shifting from being a child to being an adult. Mm-hmm. And it's just this huge moment. I mean, it's really a small moment in your life, you know, just a few years where your body, your mind, your emotions, your hormones, everything is in this upheaval as it's changing. And you're starting to engage with the world without your parents. You're mm-hmm. kind of going out in the world more on your own. And your mind has developed to be able to have more like theoretical ideas and look at things in from other people's perspective. And it's just this opening up mm-hmm. of a whole new world for kids. It's a fascinating time.
And the other thing, at least for me, I remember is this sense of, you know, being expected to act like a grown-up, but not having the privileges of being a grown-up. And this tug of war between, you know, I'm a grown-up, but then society not treating me as a grown-up, and also sort of part of me realizing that I really wasn't a grown-up. I really struggled with my hormones, and I have no doubt it's my hormones, because I used to have rages, monthly rages that I did not understand at the time. And it caused so much confusion and frustration in my life. I actually had a job once where, you know, it was an okay job, but I got so angry once I actually kicked a door off the hinges because I was just in this rage. And I look back now and I realize, you know, it had to do with my hormones were out of whack. And I think a lot of teenage girls experience this. And I've talked to a lot of teenage girls who have detransitioned, and they talk about it's not PMS. It's a little bit more serious. It's dysmenorrhea, that they're starting to identify that a lot of these girls have, you know, some significant hormonal imbalances going on, which is causing them to have all kinds of even more amplified feelings than what, you know, is even typical for teenagers. And so I think that makes, you know, being a teenage girl even harder. And these kids are even more likely to sort of fall into this transgender narrative because of it.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the insidious things that the gender industry is telling kids. Oh, puberty is uncomfortable because you're going through the wrong kind of puberty. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a girl, then, oh, you're not supposed to be a girl. You should be going through a boy puberty or vice versa. And that's such a lie. Puberty is uncomfortable for everybody. Nobody. I don't think anybody watching this would look back on your 13, 14, 15-year-old self and go, oh, yeah, it was a breeze. No problem. I'd totally do that again. You could not pay me enough to go back and live those years again. And you were talking about remembering the rages that you felt. Mm-hmm. I had a bit of that, but I think what I experienced more was, how'd I describe it? Like melancholy, like a really deep cyclical monthly melancholy. And I go back and read some of my journals and you'd swear I was about to off myself because like, I'm ugly and nobody likes me and I'm stupid and I hate myself. And then 2 days later, I'm like, do, everything's fine.
Yeah.
And it takes a while to recognize like, oh, this is that thing coming back around again. I just need to suck it up and get through the next few days and I'll be okay. But to tell kids, oh yeah, the reason you feel that way is you're transgender. No.
Well, and kids believe things, teenagers believe things that are just so absurd. I thought I was absolutely hideous, like a blight on the earth, like so ugly that I was sort of like, you know, offensive. And so I, you know, I was sort of that kid who grew her bangs out this long and walked around like this. And I look back on pictures and I'm just like, aw, like, why did I think that? But especially in those teenage years, kids get these ideas in their head and it's so easy for them to, you know, get these misperceptions about them. I would encourage parents watching this to read Reviving Ophelia if you have a teenage daughter, because that is, you know, it was written a long time ago, but it gives such good insights into the brains of teenage girls. And again, things have gotten, I think, even worse for teenage girls. When I was a kid, for whatever reason, my mom got me a subscription to Teen Magazine, which was probably the worst thing she could have done, because I did not look anything like the girls in Teen Magazine. I, you know, had dark hair. I was, you know, I thought I was chubby. I look back now and I don't think I was particularly chubby. I had, you know, self-esteem issues, and the teen magazine sort of reinforced all these ideas about me that were negative. So I would recommend, you know, stay away from stuff like that for your daughter. But now they're bombarded with these images on social media, and boys are too now. I noticed my son, he's so self-conscious. In ways that I wouldn't expect a boy to be, but these kids are just constantly being bombarded. And I think one thing that it's hard for adults to remember is that, you know, a couple of months in a teenager's life is so much longer proportionally in their life than a couple of months for us. And their sense of, you know, proportion is very different. So I remember when I broke up with my first real boyfriend, and I was just distraught. And I remember my grandma called and she said, "It's okay, Erin. There are plenty of fish in the sea." And I just wailed, like, "Oh, you don't understand. Like, he's the only one." And I was convinced he was the only one that would ever connect with me. And of course, that wasn't true. But he was the first. And you know, with teenagers, because they don't have that life experience, everything seems bigger and the consequences seem more powerful. And, you know, anytime you're not connecting with your friends, it seems so much more, you know, like the impact is just so much more powerful. So I think that's something parents need to remember, is that these kids, you know, their bodies are growing really rapidly. They're having all these physical changes. Emotionally, they're changing. Their brains are cognitively, you know, really quick. So a lot of times these are kids, you know, they're able to understand calculus, but they still might not be emotionally developed as you would think they should be.
Well, that's a good point too. People develop at different rates in terms of their intellectual abilities, their emotional abilities. And so, yeah, you might have a child who's academically very gifted, but who socially is a little behind, especially with some of the neuroatypical kids, like kids who are on the autism spectrum. You will find those disconnects between the different parts of their lives, which is really important to keep in mind. But going back to what you said about kids' sense of proportion, I've got three kids right now. They're 13, 15, and 17. As we're making this, we're still dealing with COVID, and we've been in lockdown for over a year now. And I realize for my 13-year-old, that's 1/13 of her life. That's almost 1/10 of her life. And kids don't really remember the first 2 or 3 years. So, I mean, this is huge for her. I'm in my 50s. I'm like, yeah, it's a year, you know, the year will end. We'll get over it. Years go by really quickly. And this is a little bit, I'm always doing these tangential things. But I remember when I was in high school, my English teacher explained why time seems to go faster as you get older. Mm-hmm. And she said, it's because we judge our lives based on the whole span of our lives. Mm-hmm. So when you're 2 years old, a year is half of your life. Wow. When you're 10 years old, a year is a tenth of your life. When you're 50 years old, a year is only a 50th of your life. And so you keep judging time based on that length of your own life. And that was so powerful to me to recognize for younger people, yeah, a month or two is significant. Mm-hmm. And we're going through 13 for the third time in our household. This is our third rodeo with 13. And I just want to tell parents out there, if you're dealing with a 13-year-old, they really are tough. It's really a hard season. But try to remember what it was like when you were 13 and all this stuff was going on, and your friends were so important to you. And if you had a crush, that was so important to you. And you're starting to get irritated with your parents and you just wish they'd go away and leave you alone. Oh, but I really want mom to iron my shirt and I really want dad to drive me. They're so needy and so torn in so many different directions.
Well, and I think that the other thing that I think parents need to be aware of is that, you know, some of these kids are acting in ways that are very grown up. There are going to be 13-year-olds who are sexually active that are, you know, that are going to be engaging in behaviors that typically, you know, a couple generations ago weren't going to be happening until they were, you know, 17, 18, 19, maybe not even until 20s. And so these are kids who are, you know, there are even 9 and 10-year-olds who are sexually active now. And so these are kids who are engaging in behaviors that are much more adult and that they're not actually emotionally equipped to be dealing with. And in my case, I actually started being sexually active in sixth grade. There was no way I was going to talk to my parents about it. I had some previous sexual experiences, but, you know, I actually started having sex in sixth grade. I wasn't going to talk to my parents about it. It was something that I really would have benefited from having an adult to talk to. But I knew that it wasn't something that I wanted to share with my parents. And so you might think about, you know, all the different pressures that are happening to your kids and think if there's someone that you could, you know, that your child could talk to, or even try to open up to them in a way that would be safe. You know, if my parents had, you know, somehow broached the topic in a way that made it safe for me to talk to them about it, I might have opened up. And that could really help because I was in a place where I was over my head. I was quickly, way over my head in a lot of respects and doing things that were very dangerous. I started getting involved with drugs shortly thereafter, and I was really in trouble. And I was, you know, I could have used some support from my parents, but there's no way I was going to tell them. I didn't, you know, and I don't even know what their reaction would have been. I didn't want to talk to them. I didn't really like them. I didn't feel like they were supportive. And so I think just understanding that these are kids who, you know, they're potentially going to be very different than you were at that age. You know, I hear a lot of parents talk about, you know, their first sexual experience was maybe at 17. Well, if you've got a 9-year-old who's sexually active, that's radically different than what you're dealing with.
When I did my, it wasn't my student teaching, but when I did my observation, so when you're going through teacher training, the first thing you do is go to a school and do observations. And I was in a middle school and I was seeing these posters on the wall about protecting yourself from AIDS and mm-hmm. HIV and using, you know, condoms when you're having sex. And I was like, I'm in a sixth grade hallway. And I talked to one of the teachers, I'm like, why are these posters up in a sixth grade hallway? And he said, oh, yeah, there are kids here who need this information. Well, now we know that in the public schools, in a lot of ways, they're pushing kids. You know, a Barna Group survey said one out of three kids feels that today's sexual ed programming in schools encourages kids to have sex. They feel pressured to have sex. Yeah. So something's going wrong there. But that is happening.
And that's really different because when I was in sixth grade, there were only a few of us and we were very sly about it. You know, we were sneaking around. It was not, there was no tacit approval by our teachers or by, you know, by the system at all. And so it's so different now. And so I'm thinking if there were kids when I was a, you know, when I was in sixth grade doing it, I'm absolutely positive with the way sex ed is now being pushed. And they're suggesting that sex is now a right. And again, kids don't have the cognitive ability to really understand the implications of sex. You know, our bodies really aren't physically mature enough to handle it. And that's one reason why, you know, I advocate for kids to wait because really they're not ready for it, but they're now being pushed into it. And so again, these are kids, you know, this generation of kids is being pushed to grow up so much faster than most of the earlier generations were. And they're just, they don't have the skills to cope. And so that cognitive dissonance that we had as teenagers is even worse than it was for us.
Yeah, well, you raise an interesting point. Kids are not good at making decisions about long-term consequences. And that's a biological thing. We've got a clip from a researcher talking about the adolescent brain. And that the frontal cortex is one of the last things that develops. The frontal cortex doesn't actually finish development until you're in your mid-20s. And that's the part of the brain that deals with long-term planning, with consequences, with looking at what you're doing today and what that could affect you in the future. And we cannot rush that development. Kids are being pushed earlier and earlier and earlier to behave like adults. And sadly, I just saw in Washington State now, kids' medical records are being made independent to the child at the age of 13. Parents are being cut off their kids' medical records at the age of 13. That's horrific, horrific, because these kids do not have the cognitive capacity to handle their own healthcare records.
Yeah, to even understand the implications of what, you know, these incredible medications like, you know, you talked about the AIDS awareness in schools. Well, they're giving PrEP, which is a, you know, a prophylactic medication cocktail to kids to prevent them from getting AIDS. Well, just like with puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones, we don't know what the long-term implications of children taking these incredibly heavy-duty medications are going to be. And children don't have the ability to think long-term about it. You know, I remember, again, I started smoking when I was 9. One of the things that I used to do is I would go to the mall and I would pick cigarettes out of the ashtrays right by the elevators and smoke them. And I thought it was pretty cool. Now I look at it and I'm like, blah, you know, this is just gross on so many levels. That one first. I actually am now kind of a germaphobe. But at the time I thought I was pretty clever. You know, what a great way, because a lot of times, you know, you wouldn't just get cigarette butts, you get some pretty nice sized cigarettes. And again, that's a lack of, you know, that long-term thinking. Yeah. And so it's like these, you know, people pushing you know, the trans movement, the PrEP, these, you know, sexualizing kids, they're really preying upon the fact that kids don't have the cognitive ability to assess long-term consequences. And should we just go ahead and watch that clip?
Yeah, let's do that.
The brain continues to develop right throughout adolescence and into the 20s and 30s. So adolescence is defined as the period of life that starts with the biological, hormonal, physical changes of puberty and ends at the age at which an individual attains a stable, independent role in society. It can go on a long time. One of the brain regions that changes most dramatically during adolescence is called prefrontal cortex. So this is a model of the human brain, and this is prefrontal cortex right at the front. Prefrontal cortex is an interesting brain area. It's proportionally much bigger in humans than in any other species, and it's involved in a whole range of high-level cognitive functions, things like decision-making, planning what you're going to do tomorrow or next week or next year, inhibiting inappropriate behavior, so stopping yourself saying something really rude or doing something really stupid. It's also involved in social interaction, understanding other people, and self-awareness. So MRI studies looking at the development of this region have shown that it really undergoes dramatic development during the period of adolescence. Ability to take into account someone else's perspective in order to guide ongoing behavior, which is something, by the way, that we do in everyday life all the time, is still developing in mid to late adolescence. So if you have a teenage son or a daughter and you sometimes think they have problems taking other people's perspectives, you're right. So for example, take risk-taking. We know that adolescents have a tendency to take risks. They do. They take more risks than children or adults, and they are particularly prone to taking risks when they're with their friends. There's an important drive to become independent from one's parents and to impress one's friends in adolescence.
Wow, I really recommend for everybody watching this to go back and watch that whole video. Yeah. It's so informative and so interesting. But one of the things she talks about in there is brain pruning. Mm-hmm. And when we hit about 12 years old, our brains start actually pruning synapses and pruning connections. It's a little scary if you think about it, because parts of your brain are dying when that happens. But for small children, they are just sponges. They are sponges absorbing language, absorbing experience. And then about the age of 12, your brain starts to cut off parts that aren't being used. And it strengthens the parts that are being used. So if your child is into music, some of those music areas are going to be left intact, are going to be strengthened. But if your child hasn't learned a second language, some of those language synapses are going to start to be cut. Kids prior to the age of 12 learn languages so quickly. After the age of 12, you don't have the same capacity for language learning. And that's one of the things that comes with that brain pruning. But what's really scary, and Aaron, I'm going to ask you to talk about this, is the drug Lupron, which is being given to kids to block puberty, because kids are told this lie. If you're uncomfortable with puberty, you're going through the wrong puberty, we need to stop. And what happens to the brain?
Right. And that's what's so important is people, they talk about, this being a pause button so that kids can, take some time and consider their gender identity. And I can't think of anything more ludicrous, first of all, because what you're doing is you're pausing their cognitive development, the very cognitive development that they need to make good choices about their future. And so, Lupron isn't a pause, it's actually inducing a developmental delay. So as their peers are moving through puberty and gaining these emotional, social, cognitive abilities, these children are being delayed in all of these areas. There's research that shows that their limbic system is being delayed, their IQ is going down, their social emotional development is being delayed. All of the things that they need to make good choices about their long-term future are actually being stunted. And so their ability to make good choices about whether to take a medication that's going to cause long-term side effects and medicalize them for life really is compromised. So it's really ludicrous to expect that this is a good treatment for them. It's really incredibly dangerous to induce a developmental delay in a child.
And we don't know what the effects of Lupron are on a child's developing brain. There's no studies.
Not long term.
No, this is being used off label.
Right.
And we don't know what if that brain pruning has not happened yet and you start a child on Lupron. What if they're in the middle of the brain pruning process and you introduce this drug that stops development? What does that do to that child's long-term brain development? We don't know. And to me, that says we need to be extra cautious.
Yeah.
But we're not.
I've heard doctors say that in any other case, we take a drug, we experiment with it, we determine, you know, how to best use it, what its pros and cons are, and then we start prescribing it. In this case, it's just the opposite. And I have heard, you know, people who advocate for the use of Lupron using precocious puberty to justify its use. And Lupron has been used in precocious puberty. And what is precocious puberty is when, you know, a young child starts to go through puberty really early, say, you know, a five-year-old starts to develop breasts or something. And so they have used something like Lupron for a couple of years to delay that in a very young child. However, they are finding, even in those cases, that Lupron often has some really heinous side effects, that these kids are having bone demineralization and joint pain and other really negative consequences. So it's not as though, even in that case, it's been a great drug. The other instance is that in those cases, it's only used for a couple of years. In a lot of cases with kids who have a trans identity, it's being used for many, many years. So 3, 4, 5 years. And we have no evidence about what the long-term consequences are going to be on something like that. But the more, you know, all the research is showing that we should be, you know, immediately stopping, that this is incredibly dangerous, that these kids are being harmed. And like you said, if a child's brain, you know, there are these are developmental
milestones.
And if we interrupt them, we really don't know what the consequences are going to be. And to me, it's just outrageous that we have been willing to experiment on children. An unregulated experiment is taking place with these children, and we are sitting back and watching it. And to me, it's outrageous. It really, there's no way of justifying it. And we should be up in arms. And thankfully, there are some people who are fighting this. And thankfully, Arkansas just passed a law saying that at least in Arkansas, this isn't going to happen anymore. I'm hoping that other states will follow suit. We need to protect kids from this because, again, I just have nightmares, literally wake up at night in cold sweats, thinking about these children and the damage that's being done to them.
Well, you've spoken to so many young adults who thought they had a trans identity and then they detransition and they're horrified at what's been done to their bodies. Wow. And I'm really scared for this generation of kids. I love this age. I just love tweens and teens. I'm fascinated by them. And I am just heartbroken and horrified at what's happening to this generation of kids as they are growing into adulthood and the gender industry is trying to stop them from becoming healthy, functional adults. And why do we have this fascination with youth?
Yeah.
And why would we prevent people from becoming adults?
To me, it's really demented. I mean, I think about, you know, yes, we all acknowledge that puberty is a difficult time, but it's also such a critical time. Like, it's sort of like saying, you know, in order to bake a cake, we have to put it in this hot oven. Well, we don't want to have to put it in the hot oven. You know, that would be awful to put it in a hot oven. Let's not do that.
The
cake won't like that at all. You know, but it's the heat that cooks the cake. And that's how it is in, you know, puberty is a difficult time, but it's also a beautiful time because it's when we develop into adults, we learn so much. I mean, I think about some of the experiences that I had and some of, you know, just the opportunities and the learning that took place. I actually had a really difficult time in elementary school for, you know, I was diagnosed with dyslexia. I can't even remember when, but I had such a difficult time learning how to read, and something clicked when I was a teenager and suddenly I could read. And it was like the world opened up to me. And I just remember gobbling books. You know, it was this time where I just was like, I felt like I can't even explain it. And the wonder in the world, you know, going in hikes and I remember the first spring where I was out in the woods and I heard the pine cones popping open, that soft sound of pine cones popping open. You know, there's just so much wonder in the world. And to deny children that opportunity to go through that development and falling in love. These are children who are, they're going to be denied that sexual development. You know, the boys are going to be denied the opportunity of having orgasms. You know, these are important human experiences that they're going to be denied. And I know parents might feel kind of squeamish thinking about their son's, you know, sexual development or their daughter's sexual development, but these are part of human development that are super important, that are, you know, again, puberty blockers are going to stop that sexual development.
I was just thinking about all of the coming of age books and coming of age movies. Mm-hmm. It's a huge genre. Movies like Stand By Me, mm-hmm. like The Maze Runner, mm-hmm. The Bridge to Terabithia, all of these movies and books that are about this pivotal mm-hmm. point in kids' lives, there's a reason that's a genre. That's its own genre in entertainment. And we're taking that away from kids. We're taking that away from them.
Yeah, it is heartbreaking. And parents need to fight for this. And again, you know, I guess maybe there are parents who think, you know, putting their child on puberty blockers will make parenting easier because they won't have teenagers in the house, but it's not worth it. Oh my gosh. I would never want to give up any of the, you know, fights that I've had with my kids to induce that kind of a developmental delay on them. Every one of those difficult times I've had parenting has been worth it for them to be able to grow up into a functional, thriving adult.
Yeah. A lot of teachers and parents that I talk to are very scared about the teenage years. Mm-hmm. They're just afraid of so much that comes with that. And I just want to encourage parents, excuse me, don't fear the teenage years. It's new, it's different. Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's harder. Mm-hmm. There are definitely challenges that come with it, but you have such an opportunity to grow along with your kids and to learn about yourself. And watching your kids going through these years, you can look back on your own experience and go, oh, that's why I did that. Or, oh, I don't want my child to make that mistake. You know, I'm going to share this with them. That's our role as a parent, is to help our kids through these years, to help them into adulthood. They're not going to appreciate it most of the time. They're not going to, oh, thanks, Mom, for putting these boundaries around me and for protecting my health and for guiding me. You'll get that when they're in their 20s and 30s.
Yeah, and that's something I want to remind people of too, is that, you know, I had, when my daughter was, you know, 16 or 17, we didn't have like this, you know, mom, daughter, you know, cuddle and love and, you know, things weren't, you know, always hunky dory. You know, there were times where we weren't talking and she was mad at me and she thought I was a jerk. But now that she's a young woman, we have a great relationship. You know, there was about a year and a half where she didn't want anything to do with me. And it was really hard, but she needed that differentiation. She needed that time to find herself. And now we are buddies again. So again, for parents, that can be really hard. If you've been really close to a child, that time when they are, you know, sometimes rejecting you, that can be really tough, but sometimes you need to allow that, because that's part of being a teenager, is they find themselves, they need to have that independence. And then if you allow that, then they can come back to you when they're adults and you can have a relationship as adults, which can be wonderful.
Yeah, this is really a necessary part of adolescence, because your child has inherited an identity from your family. Mm-hmm. They are part of this family up until adolescence. They've pretty much gone along with what you believe, gone along with your rules, gone along with your perception of what the world is like. And part of adolescence is starting to separate from that, not necessarily rejecting it, but stepping back and saying, do I believe everything my parents taught me? Do I agree with everything that they've said? And that is a necessary part of growing up, because you want your child to be a fully functioning adult one day who can start a family and be successful in his or her own right. But a necessary prerequisite of that is that they separate from their family of origin. Mm-hmm. And it is very, very painful. My youngest daughter and I were just, I mean, she just was mommy love. Like, I don't think anybody's ever loved me as much as that little girl. She just adored me. And in some ways I have dreaded the teenage years, because I knew it was going to happen. And it's happening now that she's separating. And sometimes we'll have these really sweet, close times. And then other times she treats me like I am a leper and the most embarrassing human on the planet. And why does she have to be in this family with these awful people? That's just the way it is. Yeah. That's just the way it is.
Yeah. So do we have some questions from parents, Maria?
We do. We have two questions. Oh, I love this first one. How do I get my teenager to understand that he is brain impaired? Ooh. That he actually does not have a mature adult brain development yet?
I think the first way I would respond to that is that they're not brain impaired, that they're very appropriate for their age. Mm-hmm. And that's important to understand, that developmentally this is very appropriate. And I think that, you know, sometimes it's easy for parents to kind of condescend to their parents or to their children, and to suggest that there's something wrong with their kids. And I think we saw that a little bit in the video, that there's, and if you watch the whole video, there's this sense, you know, it's easy as a parent to be like, to sort of put teenagers down and be like, what is wrong with them? But there's nothing wrong with them. They're exactly where they're supposed to be developmentally. So I think if you can kind of couch it in those terms, and then work with that, and explain to kids, you know, this is how you are now. I know it, you know, it feels like this, but this is where you are, and this is why you're seeing things like this. I think that's going to be the most effective way of dealing with, rather than saying, oh, you're brain impaired. Because as soon as you say that, your kid's going to shut you off.
Yeah. Well, I liked what you said about couching it in those terms of that there is actually nothing wrong with you, mm-hmm. but you're not done maturing yet. Yeah. You know, you're still on a path of maturation. And honestly, we all are, all our lives.
Yeah.
I think about who I was in my 20s, and I'm very different than I was in my 20s. I've continued to learn. I've continued to grow. I've continued to mature. Adolescence is a time where that's like really exploding and happening very quickly, but it does continue all throughout someone's life. And I think even having a little bit of humility when you talk to your kids and say, you know, I still make mistakes.
Yeah.
I still do things that later I look at and go, oh, that wasn't a great idea.
Yeah.
I want to help you as much as I can to help keep you from making those mistakes. And sometimes we do just have to put our foot down as a parent and say, you're under 18, you're still in my house, I still have authority. I'm sorry, I know you don't like this, but I'm saying no to this, mm-hmm. because I'm looking at the long-term consequences and I'm thinking there's an awful lot of risk here. Mm-hmm. And this just popped into my head. One of the things my husband often talks about, and we talk about this with our kids, is risk management.
Mm-hmm.
And there's two parts to risk management. There's the likelihood of the thing happening, and there's the consequences of the thing happening. And so if we can kind of talk to our kids about that, like, well, okay, so you want to go to this party where there's no adults there. What's the likelihood of something going wrong? What are some things that could go wrong? What are some of the consequences of that? And kind of help kids to learn how to manage risk. How do you actually think about risk and make decisions about risk?
That is really good. And that would have helped me so much as a teenager. Nobody ever approached me with stuff like that. And I had no skills for doing that. So I would highly recommend that.
Yeah. Well, one more question. How does a parent decide what to take seriously and have empathy and validation for, and when it's appropriate to say, this is ridiculous, knock it off?
That's a good question. And I've talked to a lot of parents, and it can be really hard, especially parents who are dealing with a kid with a gender identity issue, who can be very dramatic, who can be very insistent that the parents behave certain ways. However, I think that you're going to get further with your kid if you honor the idea that for the child, this is real. And so even if you believe that it is ridiculous, it's okay to validate their feelings. I think being a kinder person is never going to be a problem. I think as, you know, as a parent, you can be firm, you can be strict, you can set good boundaries, but I think being kind is never gonna be hurtful or harmful to your child. I don't know about you, but there have been a few times where I have done or said something that sort of indicated to my child that I thought they were being ridiculous, and it didn't go over well. And so I think, you know, sometimes, of course, as parents, we don't have the energy, because it does take emotional energy to validate children. But I think if you can validate that their feelings are real, what they're feeling is, you know, not necessarily right or wrong, but that it's real for them, that it will allow you to have a stronger relationship with them.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I just want to clarify that word kindness has gotten subverted a lot in the culture today. Today, if you talk about kindness, most people think that means never saying anything that somebody else doesn't want to hear, never telling somebody they can't have something. And that's not kindness. Kindness is making sure that you're giving that person what they really need. And sometimes people need things that they don't want. And sometimes our kids need things that they don't want. But you're right, there's a difference between saying, this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard, you're being an idiot, and saying, you know what, I can see that this is really important to you and that this really bothers you. I don't agree with your conclusions, but I understand that this is really painful.
Yeah.
There's a big difference in the reaction that you're going to get there.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I see this with my son. He's 17 and he plays disc golf, and he gets very angry when he misses a shot. And if I say something like, yeah, bad shot, it doesn't help. If I say something like, ah, that was a bummer, or, oh, I can see how disappointed you are, it really helps. Yeah. And it builds our relationship. And so, again, I know it's hard to be a parent, and, you know, every once in a while, I, you know, we all make, you know, snide remarks to our kids, and that's going to be normal. They're going to make snide remarks to us. But I do feel like the more you can try to, you know, even if you completely disagree with them, do it in a way that is respectful, that it will go over better than if you are dismissive.
We are not doctors or therapists. We are not giving medical or psychiatric advice, and we offer no guarantee of outcomes. We simply want to talk about how to support and love kids using long understood best practices from the fields of psychology, education, and child development. We're glad you joined in our conversation today, and we hope that you took away something you can put in your toolkit for parenting your gender-confused kids with truth and love.